Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. It's a slightly different episode this week. In as much as they're the same, this one's different. I speak to someone about a book that they've written. I'm speaking with Dougal McNeil about a book that he wrote with Charles Farrell called Writing the 1926 General Strike. This talk that I have with Dougal is intercut and begins with some speeches from the launch of the book. The book was launched on the anniversary of Ernie Abbott's murder, and it was held at the Trades Hall, which was the site of the terrorist act that took Ernie's life. So the first voice that you hear is Helene Prattley. She introduces the event, and then Peter Craney gives a speech which memorialises Ernie, but also puts the terrorist act in sort of context of New Zealand history and trade union history. Then Grace Miller gives a speech that sort of helps us to look forward a little and helps us to think about where the trade union sits in society at the moment, and also helps to put the book that Charles and Dougal have written into context, into that kind of historical context. So, it's lovely to have so much talk about workers and about the trade union movement. So, I really hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Well, I would just like to welcome everyone here today. So this event today has two parts. Firstly, we are here to remember and meet annually to pay our respects to Ernie Abbott and to remember the Trades Hall bombing. The second part is a book launch for Dougal and Charles, which is also a fundraiser for the Living Wage campaign. Please give generously what you can, and every bit is appreciated, and it's a very strong campaign. And of course, enjoy the company of our friends and comrades that we have here today. I would like to ask Peter Craney to come forward. He is a strong legal force for our movement, and he will be saying a few words today about Ernie and leading us in a minute's silence.
Comrades and friends, it's very pleasing to see this gathering tonight. Some of you, but not all of you, may have been at the last gathering, which was 1 year ago today, which was the 30-year anniversary of the terrible act of violence that took place in this place where we are now standing. A terrible act of terrorist violence. In fact, this was the spot. The meeting that took place 1 year ago decided that rather than wait for another 5 or 10 years, that we would try to meet annually, and that leadership of this issue would pass to younger generations than me. So I think it's safe to say this is my last speech on this topic, and when we meet next year, I'll be in the audience listening to somebody younger. At the time of the murder of Ernie, there was, shortly afterwards, an approach made to the Wellington City Council. And the request that was made to the council at the time, but was rejected, was that we should rename the park, the small park across the road here, as the Ernie Abbott Park. And that demand was rejected. I would like to revive it. Even if it takes us another 30 years. They did agree to plant a tree, but the tree was so small it didn't survive. And they have now agreed, in a small step forward, but not the complete demand, to plant a totara tree across the road, which is a bit more developed and is going to stand in memory of Ernie. He was not what you would call a heroic figure. Yeah. I mean, you notice I'm dressed up like a box office clerk because I've been to the court today. I actually had to buy a shirt for $35. He would have been the first one to give me a bit of a mouthful for wearing it. But like Christine Clark, like Frederick George Evans, Ernie Abbott was a worker, and he was one of us. He was just an ordinary person killed in this terribly violent atrocity. So we should not see him as being apart from us. He was us. It was us that was attacked that terrible day. So it's good that we're all here today. Some of us who were there are getting older, and some of us who were around at the time have been struck with sickness, as some people may know. But our great movement and our cause is going to live forever. And Ernie was one of the people that contributed to the cause of human freedom and human dignity. And I would like to invite everybody to just reflect for a minute's silence in memory of Ernie.
I am in a tutorial room in Von Zedlitz with Dougal. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Oh, that's
thank
very good. Yes. Oh, it's very nice to be here. So
The launch last night, we went to the launch last night. It was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I would like to backtrack to something extremely simple. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit. Harry Ricketts gave sort of a potted history of the general strike. And I just wonder if you had to, what are the important parts of it for you, do you think? Like if you were explaining it to an alien who'd come from outer space, what sort of things characterise it?
Well, it is to date the only national general strike that's happened in British history. So it was the great confrontation between Labour and capital in Britain, between the wars involving millions of people, both as strikers and as strike breakers, drawing whole communities, particularly in Wales, whole villages into the struggle. And so it really shaped and defined how British society was to go from that point. The dominance of the conservatives, conservative politics, the conservatization or the sort of move towards more conservative politics in the Labour movement and in the Labour Party came out of that defeat. The breaking of traditions of radical unionism in the miners' unions took generations to recover. So it was a very, very, very significant defeat, which is unfortunately, I think, the most important thing about the general strike. But also, and what our book explores a little bit, I think, is as an inspiration, as a vision, as an example of a time when we did pull off this thing, a general strike, it lived on in the folklore and the memory and the oral traditions, the written traditions of the British working class for several generations, all the way through the 20th century. And so it stands both as a great defeat and an instance of the defeat of Labour by capital and of, many would argue, the betrayal of the movement by its leaders, and also as an inspiration of what could be achieved, what could be done.
So with the huge watershed that it was, I suppose, then a book that explores the way your book explores seems like a natural, you know, seems natural. But can you talk a little bit about maybe the genesis of the project, or, you know, like what like it seems absolutely logical that we have a book like this, but there hadn't really been one before.
That's right.
And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about what the motivation was or that kind of thing.
Well, the project was initiated by my co-author Charles Ferrell, who is a specialist in modernist literature and the literatures of Britain in the early 20th century. And Charles had written a book on a book called Modernist Writing and Reactionary Politics in 2001, and he published around Lawrence, Eliot, Joyce, all the big names. And he had been struck by this absence that was hiding in plain sight, that the general strike generated a vast archive of literature. Many, many, many significant writers were involved either practically as volunteers or strike breakers. Several very important works were being written as it was happening, or were directly inspired by it, or produced in response to it. And yet, as you say, there'd been no book written about it. There were a handful of articles in the 1970s, a few pieces in academic journals, but this big watershed event largely had gone missing from the annals of literary history. And I think Charles's hunch led us both, once we started collaborating, to sort of hunt out the general strike and to ask why, if it was everywhere visible, it had been less explored in literary history than it should have been.
Did you come up with an answer to that? Like, do you have a hunch about why it hadn't been more fully explored? Like, yeah.
I think there's a few answers. One, most importantly, in the history of literary criticism, I think, is to do with how modernisms came to be taught and studied, and the ways in which modernism was made as a thing to be studied, you know, made as an object of academic criticism in the 1950s and slightly earlier, involved an evacuation of its politics.
And
the great modernists were read in the first kind of generation, so to speak, of modernist criticism with an ear to aesthetic autonomy, to the distance of their works from society, and so on and so forth. And so this primed critics to underread social and political aspects of their work. I think that's one reason. I think the second is that it falls between periods in literary history. Yeah, that you have the pre-war, you have the war poets, you have all sorts of thinking about that writing. You have 1922 and the wasteland and ways of imagining the modernists. You have the 1930s, the Great Depression, the Auden generation, returns to something called realism and prose, and 1926 sort of sits oddly in those ways of dividing up texts. That way of reading the modernists obviously is a very old-fashioned one now, and there's been work over the last 30 years, very good work, drawing attention to context, to region, to nation, to gender, to sexuality, to who gets excluded, to the colonial context, and all the rest, and we've drawn on that criticism. But I think as a result of the defeats that the workers' movement suffered since the 1980s and since Thatcherism, the question of class and of class conflict and of class as both an identity and a relationship has been understudied and neglected in the academy. And so while there have been a number of really rich and stimulating rereadings of the modernist canon, this question of class conflict is still under explored in the academy. And so I think that's another reason why the general strike has been of less interest to critics, perhaps, than it should be.
Because that was, I must admit, that was one of the pleasures of reading some of the sections of the book, was sort of taking these works and re-emerging them, submerging, you know, like sort of re-putting them back in their societal kind of context. And I just found that incredibly fulfilling in a way, because I know that, you know, when I was at university, the way that I was taught modernism was in that vacuum, you know, and it just... it must, I don't know, does it feel rewarding to bring them back to their, to that idea of class and that idea of society around it?
Well, some works, I think, become lost without that, don't they?
Yes.
You know, there are works that you can vacuum up out of their context and still find extremely rewarding and read in different ways and translate into different periods. There are other works, though, that I think for us the challenge is learning how to see them as once having been fresh.
Yes.
And the example in the book obviously is Lady Chatterley's
Lover,
if you nowadays, quite rightly in the light of feminist criticism and all sorts of other developments, if you read the moments where Lawrence is trying to be heartfelt and earnest and passionate and erotic, you fall about laughing.
Yes,
you know, they're strange. You know, it's an odd, overwrought book. But for more than one generation of men and women, this was an intensely moving, serious moral vision. And so the challenge, I think, for a critic is to try and imagine themselves into a situation where what to us reads as risible and just kooky, strange, can be imagined. Under what circumstances could this have been an affecting and moving experience?
Yeah.
And that's what we tried to do in the chapter. I think part of looking at the ways in which Lawrence's drafting and redrafting of that book come out of some very difficult personal experiences with his own family and childhood and family responses to the strike, that then map out onto a whole social experience or the experience of a whole region. And so the ways in which the biographical and the social interact that was great fun to read, yeah. To write around.
Yeah.
Comrades, colleagues, friends, thank you all for coming. I'm going to wrap up with some general thanks, many of which we need to make. We've incurred many, many debts through the course of the writing and the production of this book, and then I want to end by saying something very briefly about the connection between the book launch and the Living Wage campaign. And after that, once I've stopped speaking in lieu of applause, you can rattle your loose change as you put it into the buckets. Dennis Glover said at some stage during the 70s when he went on a tour of New Zealand reading his poetry that he enjoyed events like these because it was a chance to meet old friends and make new enemies. the first thing I want to make is just to everyone who came along from all the different unions, from all the different parts of our life, different organisations, different strands in the workers' movement. It's really hugely appreciated and hugely appreciated by all of us in the Living Wage Public campaign. I want in particular to thank, because I think they both had to leave by now, Lindy McIntyre, who's Tyler's campaigner for the Living Wage and is working for the Living Wage up in Victoria, and seems, if you sort of follow her on Facebook or see her in the news, is it everything all the time. I'm raising the profile of this, and we're enormously grateful to her for the work that she's doing. Also want to thank Rebecca Matthews, who was essential to making this event happen. When we started working on the book, Rebecca was organising fundraisers for the Meatworkers Union, who were locked out. Now that we're launching the book, she's organising fundraisers for the Living Wage campaign. All the way through, she's been tireless in political support for all sorts of aspects of our movement and offering solidarity. Charles and I want to thank all of our colleagues in the English programme, and indeed in the School of English, Film, Theatre and Media Studies. We want to thank them obviously for the support and collegiality that they've given us, but also to make a point as we're coming into one of these rounds of PBRF at the moment, what a privilege it is to work in a programme that values intellectual inquiry for its own sake, that stands up for liberality, that believes in the importance of the humanities, that has a commitment to literature as a social good and a good in itself. It's simply an enormous pleasure to be able to work with people that have such a profound commitment to the study, the teaching of, the reading of, and the research into literature. And we thank all of them really as much as we can. We want to give particular thanks to Harry, both for launching the book, but for friendship and generosity that he's given to both of us over many years now. It's coming up a dozen years that I've known Harry, and he's played a very important role in supporting me through some quite difficult times occasionally in my career. Two more personal thanks for me. One is to my teacher, who I acknowledge in the book, Linda Hardy, no longer works at Victoria, but was an absolutely inspirational teacher and someone without whom certainly my parts of the book couldn't have been written. And I'd like also just to acknowledge the presence in the room, in the spirit of the room, of another teacher of mine from Victoria, Judith Dale. The, my part of the book is dedicated to my family and also to my mother, Pauline, who's coming up now to her 40th year of active membership of the Pope Prost Primary Teachers Association. So one of the many reasons why the public sector and the teachers need to win a substantial pay increase this year is so my mother can afford to buy copies of the book and so on. So we need to be pushing for coordinated strike action. I have to thank my comrades in the Wellington branch of the International Socialist Organisation who carried a lot of work I should have been doing during the most difficult passages of writing the book, and for periods of absence from political work I'd taken on that was above and beyond the call of duty there. They were all very understanding, and the intellectual grounding and education I've received in that organisation is essential to what goes on in the book. I think particular thanks and special thanks due there to my comrade Shami Yoon, who far from hastening the completion of the book reminded me that there were immediate struggles that required more immediate attention from that lockout we've mentioned to other campaigns happening in Wellington in 2000, in the 2000s rather than in the 1920s. Okay, The final set of thanks we want to give, and they're very important thanks, are to colleagues of ours without whom not only the book couldn't have been written, but none of our teaching at Vic could have been done, none of the work at Vic could happen, none of the buildings at Victoria would be functional. And I'm sorry to say most of these people I'm not able to thank by name because I don't know their name. Sometimes both of us have been working late, working on chapters, trying to receive material for the book, and would be in at the office well outside of what counted as normal hours for people in our kinds of professions. And it would be at that time, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock sometimes, that we would meet people starting their work at Victoria, cleaning the toilets, collecting the waste from the offices, doing the rounds in security, doing all the sorts of things that are essential to the university functioning. The bulk of the people doing this work are not on what's recognised as a living wage. They're paid, most of them, the minimum wage, and those that are paid above the minimum wage are certainly paid well below what's being picked up and what's necessary to live an ordinary life. There's a friend of mine who works, cleans the English department, and you know, I've seen him around and met him in Newtown. I thought he's a colleague. I should introduce myself. Said, should we go for a drink? And he said, no, I've just finished my day job. I'm about to start at Victoria. This is the 2 hours break I have between job one and job two. In bargaining last year, when the Tertiary Education Union put it to our employers at Victoria University that a living wage should be paid to all staff at Victoria, and this would require a very small transformation of funding there. This message, which had been overwhelmingly endorsed by union members, I'm on the branch of the TEU at meeting after meeting around our campuses, higher paid staff members, associate professors said again and again, we will trade off a pay increase for better paid staff to get a pay increase for worse paid staff. That's what we want to see happen. Don't clap, unfortunately. That isn't how it went. We were told by the university in negotiations that they have, and I quote, philosophical objections to the concept of a living wage, and not prepared in the area. So one of the reasons why we wanted to have the book launch here was to acknowledge our colleagues and our comrades in the Tertiary Education Union, to also link this history of a struggle that's past to a struggle that's ongoing. And the campaign for a living wage at Vic is going to keep the pressure on the university management until a living wage is paid to all our colleagues. And so if we can't have a living wage for all our colleagues, we want to make as many events as possible where we both celebrate what the humanities are about, we celebrate why we have a university, why the university matters to the public, why public education matters, but we also remind ourselves we can't have that without paying the lowest paid workers something that they can live on. And so this campaign's going to keep going until we win. So expect many more events like this. And then when we have all of our colleagues on the living wage, they'll be able to afford ordering what I'm told from Harry. I heard that introduction. I thought, gosh, you know, I must read that book. I wish I'd written it. A book of the kind described by Harry, they may be able to purchase and read and enjoy themselves. So please donate generously. And thank you all very much for coming.
So, like, there are some of those big books in your book. You know, there's Lady Chatterley's Lover, there's Wolf. You know, there are kind of those bigger books. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about perhaps maybe the working class writers that are in the book. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of those books come from, you know, like, quite a elite mm-hmm. kind of class. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about the working class writers in the book.
Certainly. There's two or three groupings of working class writers in the book. That we have chapters on Scottish modernism, and so two writers very well known in Scotland and I think are well known in literary circles, but perhaps have less of a readership than they deserve, or less of a readership than someone like Virginia Woolf, and that's Hugh McDiarmid and Lewis Grassic Gibbon. And both of them were from working class backgrounds and were really, in McDiarmid's case, intimately involved in the progress of the strike. He was a town councillor. He was active through the 9 days. He was a member of the Independent Labour Party. And so his work emerged out of a kind of first-hand experience of the Labour movement. There's also a chapter dedicated to Welsh writing in English about the strike. And again, there you've got this example, this instance of writers outside of Wales, not so well known, but inside of Wales, inside of the Welsh tradition, absolutely canonical, famous figures who were also at the same time working class writers.
Mm.
Raymond Williams, the great critic and theorist, dramatist, theorist of drama and novelist, came, his father was a railwayman. Lewis Jones, who wrote We Live, very famous novel of the strike, was a miner. A number of Welsh novelists and poets had connections with mining communities. Idris Davies, the poet, had been a miner and through an injury wasn't working when the strike happened. The third group we look at in England, writers in England that have been largely forgotten, involves Alan Wilkinson's Clash, the romance, Harold Heslop's novel The Gate of a Strange Field, that was an enormous bestseller in Russia, in the Soviet Union in the late 1920s, and meant that he was something of a figure in the 20s and 30s before falling into obscurity, probably deserved obscurity, we have to say, in that case. And James Hanley, whose novel The Furies is, we think, undeservedly underread. It has a following, it's in print, Faber brought an edition out in their Faber Finds series, but he's not nearly as well known as he should be.
Mm. This is sort of veering slightly away from your book, and I mean, you may not have an opinion on this, but I have no idea how a working class writer is able to find time to write. And I feel that now, especially, and it ties into sort of that living wage stuff, that, you know, like, it feels like it squashes a voice that is just, and I'm just wondering, like, having done the work into those writers, do you have any ideas about how a working class writer can find time to write, or how, yeah, start with that. How did those, you know, those people that had full-time jobs, family, were involved in activism, you know, like, how do they find time to write, do you think? Or do you, you know, that may be something you don't have an opinion on, but yeah.
They didn't, by and large.
Yeah, exactly.
I think
is
the answer we have to start with.
Yeah.
That, I mean, the access to, there's an obvious thirst and hunger for literature and writing and creative expression in working class communities,
yeah,
then as now, and people are denied access to it.
Yeah.
So the archive of working class writing is much less than it should be for that reason, and one of the ways in which material deprivation displays itself is in the fact of cultural deprivation.
Mm.
These stories can't be told, weren't told. In some cases, I mentioned Lewis Jones, it's not a huge exaggeration to say it was at the cost of his own life. He died very young after having given, I can't remember the exact figure offhand, but scores of speeches through the course of a day in support of the Spanish Republic in the 1930s against fascism in Spain. And you see how achieving what he achieved with his life, he was a union militant, figure in the Communist Party in Wales, he wrote these massive baggy novels, he was an in-demand public speaker, there weren't enough hours in the day for the kind of life he needed to live, and I think we can say that exhaustion, malnutrition, poverty in childhood contributed to an early death there.
Yeah.
Ellen Wilkinson, another figure who died very young, she died in office in the late 1940s, and herself, I think, was only, she wouldn't have been much past 50. Clash was written in 6 weeks. It was dashed off very, very quickly.
Mm.
What's interesting as well, though, I think what your question raises is it's a very, very, very complex theoretical question for us, isn't it? Because there are ways in which other literary forms, the theatre most obviously, song, oral traditions, can keep people within a particular class setting.
Mm,
whereas writing by its nature solitary through the ways in which publishing happens in a capitalist economy. If one's successful as a writer, there are all sorts of pulls then taking someone out of their class community and their class location. And so you have a lot of novels about class dislocation, you have a lot of novels about people's experience of leaving one class and entering another. What's much more difficult to find are novels about the experience of ongoing tradition or ongoing community or ongoing location. There are partial exceptions to that in Wales, but again, that theme of dislocation comes up very strongly in the Welsh tradition, and the great novel there is Raymond Williams' Border Country, where the narrator and his protagonist has experienced this dislocation, both dislocation from Wales to London to England, and also dislocation from a working class community into the educated middle class.
Because that's I just keep thinking about the talk that you gave last night, like this idea that and it's something that's very close to my own heart, is this idea that there is this whole how would you call it, like there's this whole community of people that are allowing certain people to write and be heard, and those people, you know, don't have the same opportunities. And I think that's why like for me, one of the strangest things for me is that most of the time that I come in contact with working class writing is in the prisons, you know, because, and that just breaks my heart, you know, and not only working class writing, but Māori, Pacifica, you know, other, you know, people who are marginalised by, you know, the system that we have. And I just, that's why I just think it's so, it's really powerful when you start thinking about this idea of a living wage. And I don't know, yeah, I don't know. Do you have, is there anything more you want to add to that? Or?
Well, one thing we see, I mean, in New Zealand and in contemporary British writing as well, is that middle-class readership is perfectly happy with, in fact, enjoys spectacular representations of absolute otherness and objection. And experience of drug addiction and homelessness and this sort of vicarious peering into the self-destruction of others, always had an audience. What's much harder to find, though, is a space for writing about working life.
The drudgery
of an office, the everyday experience of a secretary or an administrator, you know, sort of the bulk of what makes up our lives, the drama and the fascination of class tension and class conflict in that setting. It's much more difficult to find, and so that plays out. I mean, you've got in trouble, haven't you, with your own stories in your novel for attempting precisely that.
It's boring.
Yeah,
the people are boring.
And that's, I think that's a symptomatic response, isn't it, of what's allowed in literature. And also, I mean, I think particularly with the short stories, the way in which they've been, or you've got in trouble perhaps for telling stories that have registered a certain lack of gratitude. I'm thinking particularly of the first story in the collection. And so, that's an ongoing tension. And one that perhaps the strike connects only tenuously to our book, but part of what Charles and I have done, I suppose, is put the strike at the centre and then read back from it. And so works that might not immediately seem to be connected to these questions of class and class conflict and politics and so on are revealed, if we've done our job right, and it's up to the reader to make up their minds about that, but if we've done our job right, these works are revealed to be soaked in class and class conflict. Taking the strike as their organising principles, a kind of way of making these things visible, I suppose.
Because I think that is one of the, you know, that's one of the real enjoyments and kind of like, you know, as reading it, kind of cheering from the side, like, you know, like I think that's one of the real successes of it, is that it does seem to return. It's interesting, that idea, isn't it? Like, I mean, one of the things that really interests me about the book as well is that often it's talking about things that are being written contemporary to the strike. Is that, and I'm interested in how, how can I put this? I've got no idea how to put this, but I'm always interested in the idea of lack of hindsight.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like that, like maybe talking a little bit about the wolf, because there were revisions made through there, through the strike, eh?
Mm.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about that? Or is that, that's not even a question, that's like just me blathering. That's great.
It's an invitation to talk, which I've
yeah,
never refused
oh,
before.
Good, good.
So, I think, again, it's an interesting question, or it's a complex and difficult question for us, isn't it? The difference between the kind of evidence that the historian can pick up of minutes of meetings or newspaper reports or written material that's produced in the moment of an historical event, and the kinds of things that we read and think about as literary critics, where literary writing is almost always, or even if it's produced very, very soon after an event, is always retrospective. It's always about memory and reworking things. And texts take on lives of their own as communities of readers reshape them and alter them by sedimenting new interpretations on them, by giving them new associations, and so on. And so one of the things that you found at the time of the strike was the use of older literature in this new context. Kipling poems being republished that had been written in World War I, now for appeals to national unity in 1926.
Mm.
Blake, Jerusalem from Milton being played on the BBC at the end of the strike as a call for national unity. So you have this great English radical and revolutionary political poem, anti-capitalist poem, being played as a hymn to the timelessness of British capitalism and so on. So the works about the strike are always looking back on the strike and always thinking about the strike's meaning and contesting its meaning for their own period as much as for trying to imagine themselves back into it. What we speculate around with Wolf is to do with the place of the strike and the composition of To the Lighthouse, that Virginia and Leonard Wolf were both involved in different ways in the strike. Leonard much more directly, but Virginia also through the activities of the Hogarth Press. Her house was a constant meeting ground of people who were actively involved in different ways. Her diary records the events of the time in quite some detail. And so what that prompted us to do, in particular Charles to do, was to reread the drafts with these questions of class resentment to the fore.
Mm.
And the great genius of Wolf, and I think it's what makes her writing so extraordinarily rich and powerful, and to my mind she's really the greatest of the modernists, is that she's at once a terrible snob and absolutely located in this haughty, patrician, upper middle class location, and utterly self-conscious and self-aware of her own position there. And so she offers these forensic and chilling self-explorations that have wonderful insights to offer about that precise class location. And it's what's so unsettling, I think, about great writers, that she can be thinking and feeling something and dissecting the thinking and the feeling in the same moment.
It's quite impressive and beautiful and unsettling. It is unsettling. That's what it really, really is, isn't it? If we think about this idea of rereading in the context of our times and that sort of thing, this is probably asking you to do what you've just said, but what does it mean to publish this book in 2015 in the current political climate? What do you think it means to raise the general strike as a lens to see these books through? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, one way of answering that question might be to look at other periods where there have been clusters of publication around it, because we're coming up next year will be the 90th anniversary of the strike. And in the 1970s and 1976, it's still within living memory.
Mm.
You've got older people who can talk about the time. You've also got in Britain very, very, very high levels of industrial struggle. You know, strike days, lost, so-called, absolute record levels. There's been successful national strikes by the miners, the first since 1926. And so when you read the popular histories of the general strike produced in the 1970s, they write about it as an event that seems contemporary.
Mm,
and they insist on the very immediate links one can draw with the present day. Ken Loach produces series Days of Hope, based on a novel by Jim Allen, at the same time that very obviously uses the strike as a springboard for arguments he wants to make about the industrial struggle at the time. You fast forward 10 years to 1986, and that entire world has disappeared.
Mm.
You know, the miners have been defeated by Thatcher in the 1984-1985 strike. Neoliberalism's on the offensive. The unions are in disarray and are being smashed back. Labour history, which had enjoyed a resurgence in the academy in the 70s, is everywhere being battened down. The horizons for working class and for radical and emancipatory ways of seeing the world are narrowing, yeah, and shrinking. So talking about the strike is always a way of contesting the present and thinking about the present. Yeah? And part of what we want to do is, I suppose, archaeological work. We'd like to dig up these books and get them a new audience.
Yeah?
We'd like to, in a modest way, I mean, obviously, you know, academic books with small readerships don't contribute much on their own, but we'd like to see ourselves as part of a revival of attention to class, attention to class criticism, a revival of Marxism in the academy,
mm-hmm.
That have been going on in the wake of the global financial crisis, yeah, and in the hopes of general strikes to come.
Can I talk? We're getting. I don't want to take. I think we're getting near the end. I'm feeling a sense of endiness, and I guess there's two things I really want to ask. First of all, I'm interested in the collaborative process of writing the book. Have you written other books collaboratively or other work collaboratively?
No.
And how? What's that experience like?
It was very stimulating.
Yeah.
Both the parts of it that were personally satisfying and also the parts that were personally difficult both helped in the book, I think.
Yes,
in that if we quarrelled over things, it meant that what came out, I think, was a better product, and it was useful to have someone to talk with. What we would do would be we read all the material together and then worked intensively on particular parts of it individually, and
right.
then would rewrite drafts back and forth. And so I hope that when you read the book, it shouldn't be clear at any stage who's responsible for any particular sentence, because they've all gone through several cycles of writing and rewriting. And it meant that there was a collaborative element, an element of conversation and debate and discussion to the thinking about the project that is, in my experience anyway, quite rare in writing in the humanities.
Mm.
You know, that our colleagues in science and economics and a number of other fields, this is the norm. You know, they collaborate on papers all the time.
Yeah.
In the humanities, it's much more the case that you sit in your study and think your thoughts on your own. I found, and I think I can say Charles feels the same way, my second thoughts, my third thoughts, in response to criticisms or comments from him, were always better than the argument I'd come up with initially.
Yeah.
And so I think I hope it's a much better book than either of us could have written on our own.
I love you talking about that, because I'm really interested in collaboration as well, and I always find that people seem to think that a strong collaboration is one where everyone comes to unanimity and then moves through like one, you know, like they become one. But I love the idea of you talking about the separateness, you know, like the how the conflict and the debate was a good part of the process, which I think is really exciting.
Yes, and I mean we've obviously come from different traditions. We have different political outlooks.
Yeah.
We have different ways of viewing things. And so, although we're broadly in the same, we have the same sympathies and we have the same ambitions, we bring to that different methods of analysis. And so, there's no attempt at unanimity in the book, but there's also, I think, it's the product of a collaboration that's separate from the argument either of us would have produced individually.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And the other thing, you mentioned humanities versus science versus, and I know, just going back to the prison again, it's very hard to justify teaching a prisoner creative writing as opposed to forklift training, and I would suggest that maybe forklift training is a better idea. But why learn humanities in this day and age? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's this push that says science, that says research, that, you know, and I just wonder, what is the strength of, you know, what's the value of a humanities education? There you go. You just have to justify your entire existence.
You've given me a platform to pontificate.
Good,
I'm
asking for hope.
It can't be a choice between the two, can it, though?
No,
because,
no.
I mean, our colleagues in science are facing the same kinds of threats.
Yeah.
And scientific research and exploration of pressing questions in science won't happen if it's pressed into the narrow confines of what's quickly marketable, what's quickly monetized, or what quickly can be justified. And scientists, as much as researchers in the humanities, feel the constraints of the kinds of demands being put on them when the interest of the scientific project itself is what drives a number of these other areas. Obviously, there's a field that are more readily linked to practical outputs, I hate to use the term, but
yeah,
the term that's,
yeah,
that's pushed on us there. With the example you raised of the prison, though, the choice shouldn't have to be between the humanities and the forklift, though, should it? Again,
no.
That what is offered is an education, and the role of the humanities in exploring how we remember, how we see ourselves, what stories have been told, what literary works are of value. I think there are two wrong answers, aren't there? One is to treat the question disdainfully, and there are too many people that are around, it seems to me, who seem to feel that being asked to defend the humanities is in itself a kind of insult or threat to the humanities. Whereas I'm reminded, reading the books and the work of other critics that I engage with in the process of this book we've written on the general strike, there's a great social good in collecting, studying, thinking about the works of our cultures, the works of other cultures. We live immersed in narratives. If you look at public library use, film attendance, video gaming, all of the kinds of ways in which people make up their day, art, literature and culture, obviously central part of ordinary lives. Yeah, so it seems obvious that we ought to be studying them and thinking about them. But then, on the other hand, I think another wrong response is too quickly to reach for the language and the vocabulary of our opponents and to talk about how, Alden or Catton winning the Booker Prize has produced X number of sales and this will bring people to New Zealand and GST receipts and so on. Alden or Catton's success is richly deserved. It's a fantastic novel. What's of value about it, though, are to do with its qualities as a novel, not, for my mind, to do with its qualities as a commodity. Yeah,
that's so true.
And so we launch this defence. There's no great justification for the humanities from the point of view of the entrepreneur or the capitalist mindset. That's not where we launch our defence. And I think if you conversations I have certainly with people from a wide range of backgrounds outside the university, there's widespread support for public education and for public research. And we have to I think it's essential that we have to fight back against and argue against the assumption being built into the discussion that, you know, the ordinary person doesn't like the pointy heads in the academy, or this is seen as a waste, or the rest. That's been drummed up by right-wing opinion. Certainly, there's very little evidence that it's widely held belief, though.
That's so true. Hey, I want to finish by asking for one reading recommendation from the book, or two. What are some books that maybe someone listening might not have heard of, but you would recommend as a really good, I don't know, just a good read?
Lewis Cressy Gibbon's A Scots Queer, which is three books, but I think it's a trilogy. I can sneak it in as one recommendation.
We'll do that.
Is the, well, they are, these three novels are amongst the most beautiful written in the 20th century. They're absolutely extraordinary works, and what they manage both in their panoramic representation of an entire social transformation in Scotland and the shift in the lives of farming people and predominantly rural people in the early 20th century is just breathtakingly impressive intellectually. They are beautiful lyrically, they're astonishingly moving, they cover great swathes of pressing questions, and they're funny page turners. And so if there was one author I'd want to take from the book and press upon people, it's Gibbon.
Wicked. Oh my goodness. Hopefully there'll be a rash.
Exactly. Yes, a rush.
Everyone will be like running to the store. That'll be wonderful. Hey, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.